Those who would distinguish between the thing as apart from our mind and the thing in relation to us attempt what is impossible, for they are as inseparable as the sun ray and the sun. The thought is the thing, the percept is the object, rather than the reverse. Every object, together with the space and time relations that go with it, is an object perceived in consciousness and nowhere else, and therefore dependent on it. What we call a material object really is the percept of a material object built in our minds, and the outward projection of a percept really is the outward object itself. That which immediately and indisputably exists for us is the finished percept. We need not hesitate to apply this principle with the utmost boldness. Locomotive engines and reinforced concrete skyscrapers, broad lakes and lofty mountains are as much mental constructs as any other things that we see amid teeming cities or in placid landscapes. It is hard at first but easy in the end to grasp this primary fact, that the supposed deliverances of sense activities, that is sensations, are themselves the objects with which we are dealing in our intercourse with the world. When we ponder reflectively, we shall find that thing and thought meet, that objective and subjective merge, that any distinction between them is arbitrary, for it is made by man and not by nature. Thus subjective and objective elements merge into unity, into radical identity. It is impossible to think thing and construct asunder when we deeply consider what they really are. Reflection relentlessly demands that we blend them into one. It is an iron necessity of the laws of thought against which no shuffling convention can prevail. What is the distinction between a thing as we see it and as it is in itself? For us there is none. The purposes of the practical activities percent of mankind quite entitle us to inquire no farther than the common view which does not take the thought for the thing. But this will not stand up to critical philosophical inquiry, which demands the whole truth and nothing less and which therefore finds that the thing is really the thought of the thing. Hence for philosophic purposes we are compelled to rub out the distinction between the thought and the thing. It might exist in nature but it does not exist in knowledge. It is impossible to prove that it is a fact and it is equally impossible to prove that it is a fiction. For the thing in itself is beyond our reach as anything other than as a thought. The setting up of a material activity in opposition to a mental one rests on the false and perverted notion of a bifurcated world containing both outside things and internal thoughts. The superficial masses immediately make this discrimination, but were they to think deeply enough they could never maintain this absurd thesis. Uninstructed and unreflective persons believe that they have direct awareness of external objects, for they call the mental construct the material object. The best philosophical psychologists know better, for they know that the mental operations concerned are the first to enter the field of awareness, as they are also the last. So long as we stubbornly persist in drawing a line between things and our perception of these things, so long shall we be unable to comprehend their real character. So long as we sever the one from the other, so long shall we find ourselves in this cul-de-sac which renders the problem wholly insoluble. Once we throw this primary error, this fundamental and fatal miscalculation, into the crucible of intent reflection, we may hope to find the true fact about our knowledge of the world but not before. The masses naturally think the magic of the mind and feel that every external thing comes first and the mental image of it is merely a copy that arises subsequently. They are not to be blamed for this. For nature hides her gold in the depths of earth and hides her truth in the depths of reflection. Habit forces us to establish this separation of thought from thing, but reflection equally forces us to repair this error. Those who will not take the trouble to pick their way through this tangled inquiry cannot hope to perceive the truth about the familiar things around them. That whether it be a pen or a pageant, each of these things is mental, is a truth which stands in direct and primary opposition to their first and foremost impressions. Nothing but the severest scrutiny of himself and the subtlest thinking within himself could ever have given man the knowledge of this amazing truth. When we carry this line of reasoning to its farthest end with thorough consistency, we cannot fail to conclude that although it has converted objects into ideas, it does not stop there, but converts ideas back again into objects. Chapter 12 The Downfall of Materialism. Let us return to our locomotive engine. Even when you stretch your hand out and feel that it is standing there in space, separate and apart from you, still the whole event occurs within your consciousness and nowhere else. For space is as mental as time. The locomotive engine is but a mental construction. Try to become aware of it without those characteristics which produce the sensations of its existence within your mind. You will find the feat impossible. Think away its color, form, hardness, weight, think away all its properties, in fact, and what will remain. There will be nothing left, because it is through the sum of these properties that you are able to perceive the engine there at all. Apostrophe admittedly slash you may say, the engine must disappear for me when there are no sensations of it, but have we not forgotten the substance of which it is made, the stuff to which these characteristics belong, the root of all these properties? Let us reflect if this be so. Can you see this substance? Yes slash you answer, it is green. But that which you see as green is a color, and it has already been shown that colors do not inhere in the things themselves. If your alleged substance is really the, then it should possess no color at all. Can you see a colorless substance in the engine? You will be forced to admit that you cannot, and that when you think of it without simultaneously thinking a color, you are compelled to imagine that some color must subsist in it and that therefore color is a part of matter. This, however, is an illusion on your part, because science has demonstrated that the colors of every object which we see, have seen, or are likely to see do not form a part of the object itself but come into being through the play of light rays upon it. In other words, the color is really an optical interpretation of the light itself and not of the object revealed by the light. The physiological analysis of sight proves that the production of color is the work of the eyes, whilst the sensation of color is the work of the mind. The feat of imagining a colorless matter is impossible, no matter how hard the mind may strive. Not the downfall of materialism to do so. It will have to assign some kind of color to every seen substance, because the two must coincide together. Therefore it is impossible to separate color entirely from any perceived object. But this leads to a curious situation. For the color cannot exist within us whilst the thing itself exists without us. They must both be together, and as we find that color finally has a mental existence, so must the object, substance or matter also possess a mental existence. Both are built up out of mind and nothing else. But how is it that colors vary if they are interpretations? What is the cause of these changes? This question brings up the complex problem of cause and effect. Immanuel Kant pointed out that this relation was a natural form of human thinking, that it is the mind which begins by believing that there is such a thing as cause and consequently seeks for it, and that there is a mysterious unapproachable substance in itself whose presence gives us the idea of material substance. What the hidden teaching has to say concerning such a substance will be explained here, but the more difficult problem of cause and effect must be reserved for the further volume. But, you will add, even if I cannot see this substance, nevertheless I can feel it with my fingers. To this the reply is that what you feel are solidity and roundness, resistance and impenetrability. But these are qualities which reach you as muscular sensations and therefore belong to your mind. They are not apart from feet, they are not the non-mental substance you allege them to be. It is impossible to separate the size and figure of an object from the color and the feeling which it produces when touched. That is, we cannot put the former outside and the latter inside the mind. They both exist and from their nature can only exist together. We are able to identify a form by its feel and color, and if we put the latter in one place and the mass or volume in another, then we are doing violence to the very act of perception and rendering it impossible. Therefore, the final conclusion is that the entire object and not merely a part of it, the entire matter of which it is composed, can exist only mentally. The earlier objection that if this doctrine of perception be true, then a large locomotive engine should not be either heavy or hard if it is composed solely of mental substance may again be mentioned as inadmissible. For we may now perceive Hotfit has confused issues and failed to grasp the true nature of the doctrine. Nobody denies the hardness and the heaviness of the vehicle. We accept both because they come to us in the form of sensations. We actually feel that we can touch but cannot shift the locomotive engine, and that it is hard and heavy. Yet the hardness, heaviness and resistance of which we become aware are known only by the mind and within the mind. This proves that the mind is entirely capable of experiencing every kind of sensation, whether it be of hardness or softness, or whether it be of heaviness or lightness. Therefore it is erroneous to declare that what is mental cannot be experienced as such substantial and touchable sensations. Were that correct, then we could never have dreams. At this point you may retire in annoyance, or if you remain it will be to persist stubbornly in asserting that there is and must be something more of the engine's stuff than mere sensations, that no delicate nervous registration like a sensation could possibly resemble a substantial thing like matter. We are forced here to ask a direct question and demand a direct answer. What is this matter like? Do what you will, rack your reason and torment your knowledge as you may, you will be unable to speak of it except in terms of sensation. You will be unable to assert in what single instance matter is different from sensation. Any view that you take of it will necessarily make it visible or touchable, smellable or hearable or tastable, that is to say, will make it reside in your sensations and hence in your mind. Let your awareness of the engine be bereft of all sensations, and there will be no engine left for you to be aware of and no material stuff to remain as a residue. Why therefore should anyone believe in this mysterious matter? We may believe in sensations because we know they exist, but this alleged matter cannot be truly grasped either by hand or mind. Substantiality exists as a sensation of the mind, whereas substance by itself exists only in imagination. The critic's matter is simply an unnecessary addition to his sensations, it is fictitious and non-existent. When closely peered into, it collapses as a mere figment of the human mind. True, pure mind is in itself as remote from sight, as alien to touch and as empty to human perception as matter. But whereas we know its effects in thoughts, ideas and images, that is in consciousness, we never know any effects of matter at all. A dictionary tells us that matter is the substance of which a physical thing is made, and it is in this sense that the word is used here. But when we open its pages again, we learn that substance is the essence or most important part of anything, and that physical means that which is of matter. The upshot of all these definitions is merely this, that all the things around us are essentially material, and that matter is matter. Looking into the dictionary has been the downfall of materialism, vain exertion. What we have really learnt is nothing more than, in Hamlet's phrase, words, words, words. The application of semantic analysis is most important here. We are often led away by the customary use of innocent-looking words to believe that they represent facts, whereas they represent only mere sounds. For analysis shows that the word matter is a meaningless one. We are entitled to write an interrogation mark all over it. We are entitled to pose the questions, has anyone observed matter in itself, as apart from the objects in which it is supposed to clothe itself? Has it ever been accessible to the five senses of man? Has anyone ever observed it before the idea of it was formed? Thus to define matter adequately is to deny it. The existence of matter or substance stripped of every quality which enables an object to exist for our senses is unthinkable. It is the totality of these qualities which constitutes the object, this we know, but the knowledge of matter itself is psychologically impossible. Apart from percepts, there is no trace of such a thing as material substance. We can pick up no object, whether it be a stick or a stone, which is not picked up in conscious experience, that is mentally. Matter, as an independent entity, stands in direct antithesis to mind, unless we recognize that it is none other than mind. The notion of the latter's immateriality will forever come into conflict with that of the former's separate substantiality. That which is present before consciousness is hardly entitled to be regarded as being more real than the consciousness itself. Matter is not different from mind, although thought to be so by those who have not inquired deeply into it. This is as true of engines as it is of the steel rails along which they run. The mental not only explains the existence of matter but also its own existence, whereas it is utterly impossible to explain the mental by the material unobjectionably. It may be disconcerting to be told that matter is only an idea, but no mind has ever been able to form a conception of this phantom in itself, but only as it is thought to be. It is the act of a child to accept the sense reports as really being reports of a material world, but that of a thinker to question them. If matter is theoretically sundered from mind, it becomes a spurious substance, a chimera, which we may seek but can never find. Such a thinker will therefore uncompromisingly repudiate its existence. Several thousand years ago, solely by the keenest possible concentration of mind, the Indian sage perceived what the Western scientist has merely begun to perceive in our own time, that matter is not the independent substance that it seems. Those who took college courses in physics hardly more than a single generation ago learnt of matter, which has since disappeared from scientific reckoning, but where it has disappeared, what scientist clearly knows? For his mind battles with the incomprehensible unless and until he is willing to turn philosopher. The unpalatable dilemma in which science will soon find itself and from which it cannot escape is, how does it know that there is a material object corresponding to the idea of it if it has never once seen a material object, and if it can never have any experience of such an object? For one of the greatest theoretical achievements of science in this century has been the dematerialization of matter. The conception of matter has undergone such a radical and rapid change that no scientist now dare dogmatize about its existence. The notion that matter is substance has been replaced by the notion that matter is wave energy. Nevertheless, the latter, although far more plausible, is still as much of an inference as the former. Matter, accepted by the man in the street, converted into waves of force by the man in the laboratory, is returned into mind by the philosopher. What we know of it is only sensation, and the sensations of light, stone or iron are entirely mental in their origin. We touch and grasp something firmly, we press and contract our muscles as we hold the solid thing in our hands, and thus seem to reassure ourselves of the existence of matter, but all that we have really done is to betray ignorance and show bias. Those who take matter to be real and, like impatient Dr. Johnson, stamped their feet impulsively on the ground to prove it, merely prove that they take their muscles as fit criterions of truth. Their triumph is grotesque and illusory. For the shape-showing muscular sensations of resistance and pressure are still sensations, and sensations in the end are events in their consciousness, that is to say, in themselves and not in matter. The muscular kind of sensation is ultimately as much mental as the visual kind. Those who regard a perceptual world as a spectral one have not understood these explanations. For it is the solid and graspable world that we daily live in. The habitual assumption that some kind of mysterious substance called matter, of which all things are composed, exists outside this perceptual world deceives them. They do not comprehend that they have assumed its existence when they ought to have questioned it. There is not the slightest evidence that anything exists in this mind-fashioned universe which is not wholly mental. It should now be clear that when we are talking about the downfall of materialism and matter, we are talking about a delusive word and not about a thing graspable by the senses, about a vague abstraction and not a concrete object, about an illusion rather than a reality. For it can neither be pictured by imagination nor justified by reason. Nevertheless, our belief in matter, this vaguest of all vague abstractions, is almost incurably ingrained. This is because we habitually narrow the mind down to the confines of the head, wrongly believing it to be kindled inside the phosphorized cerebral mass instead of habitually expanding it to contain all things perceived. We believe that we see and touch matter and even move it merely because we do not grasp this fundamental point that mind is dimensionless and measureless. Thus, mentalism is based on proven fact and not on mere inference, as is materialism. The mentalist has the positive assurance that he is not affirming a supposition or a deduction, as does the materialist, but rather an ascertained and irrefutable actuality. The materialists demand that we accept as real something which he himself confesses we cannot know in itself, and that we shall take as independent and external something which is really given only internally as an object of consciousness and which can be fully intelligible to us only through the activity of consciousness, is absurd. Materialism does not adequately explain the higher mental life. It does not throw full light on why we can form abstract ideas, why we have the capacity to conduct thought along a line of pure reasoning, the power to judge between truth and error, the creative imagination of the artist, the inventive faculty of the scientist, the ability to construct generalized ideas, the metaphysical thinking of the philosopher, and, above all, why we can reflect about our own consciousness as being an immaterial thing. Materialism never even touches the hem of the garment of consciousness. Yet such is the intellectual degradation of mankind that it irritably denounces the truth of mentalism as illusory and impulsively upholds the error of materialism as truth. Materialism succeeds in solving its numerous minor problems only by shutting its eyes to its single major problem, itself. For nobody has ever seen matter, nobody has ever handled it, and nobody has ever known where to detect its presence. Its existence is a bluff. Matter thus becomes a merely illegitimate entity in our explanation of the world, a fiction which works quite well for the purposes of practical life but becomes meaningless for the purposes of philosophical truth. When such an erroneous notion is seen for what it will simply vanish from one's understanding and be regarded no more. One will still be active in the world of things, but they will no longer be lumps of matter. They will be ideas. They will no longer be in opposition to mind but integrated with it. We have traveled far from the ordinary man's argument that matter is much too self-evident even to need discussion, for we have converted it into a significant appearance, pointing to mind as its hidden reality. Yet it is a most extraordinary anomaly of human reason that consciousness, mind, is popularly regarded as being much less real than matter, although adequate reflection reveals it as being entitled to a status of reality which is unique and primary. Popular belief, never having inquired into the truth of its intuitive beliefs, is alarmed when it first hears of this terrifying tenet of mentalism which throws doubt on a thing it has hitherto held to be beyond discussion. For there can be no way of reconciling the common sense view of the world with the philosophic fact of mentalism. In our earlier study of illusions and hallucinations, we traced their origin primarily to the natural bent of the mind to externalize its own images and to see them as separate entities. It is now of grave importance to remember that even when we know any illusions to be such, and when we have discovered and mentally corrected errors of sense, still we cannot free ourselves from perceiving them in precisely the same way in which we perceived them formerly. Their appearance continues to persist contrary to our knowledge. We may see through the deception by our power of reason, but that does not cause the deception itself to disappear. We may know by reflection and reason that the appearance which presents itself to consciousness is illusory, and yet we may be quite unable to resist its power of continued existence and its spell of solid reality. This is a positive demonstration of the complex character of our percepts and of the mysterious power of the mind to impose its own manufactures upon our senses without our personal awareness and beyond our power of control, just as it does during dream. The possibility and prevalence of these illusions should constitute a warning to all mankind and start them reflecting whether they are not subject to illusion in other matters which they habitually take to be correctly perceived. It should also guard against overconfidence when indignantly denying the frank hint that the materiality of the whole world may after all be a still wider illusion. Moreover, the public feats of jugglers and the staged phenomena of conjurers which compel us to see what is quite contrary to fact prove the downfall of materialism, that illusions may be collectively shared by a large number of people at the same time, whilst they point to the important possibility of even the whole of mankind being susceptible to a general illusion. May it not be that the collective illusions of the world's externality and materiality have arisen in the minds of all people because all share psychological and physiological similarities? When we discover how deep-seated hallucinations may sway the individual, we are prepared for the further discovery that they may also sway and coerce the collective human race. And it is a fact that the forceful illusions of materiality and externality are indeed shared persistently by all men throughout the world. For this reason, the ancient Indian sages compared ignorant mankind to a race asleep and dreaming, but compared the wise to those who were awake and fully conscious. Belief in matter, in short, is belief in a gross but mesmeric illusion. This is the emphatic message of the hidden teaching to a materialistic age, a message that also yields a warning against the useless pursuit of mere phantoms. We destroy the power of a terrifying nightmare or unpleasant dream when we awaken and discover its unreality. Similarly, we destroy the power of elusive matter, this idol with feet of clay whom myriads of blind worshippers have wrongly revered, over the mind when we awaken into truth. Yet the stupendous difficulty of this revelatory task of philosophy may be grasped by comparing it with the task of convincing a dreamer whilst he is still dreaming that his environment of houses, persons and conversations is an imagined one. We who are in the waking state live also in an imagined world, but the statement sounds as incredible to us whilst we are awake as it would to the hypothetical dreamer. The wise old Greeks said that philosophy was death. We may interpret these words as we wish. Many dying and most drowning men perceive their past as a swift rushing vivid dream. So far as human life is mental life, it is a series of ideas, that is of the same stuff as dreams. Philosophy seeks to make men realize that the entire texture of life is pure thought, but it wants them to see it here and now, not when they are dying. For if they can awaken to truth when it is most needed, that is when they are in the midst of work and living, suffering and pleasure, health and sickness, they will know how best to deal with those alternating vicissitudes from which none see an escape. Let it not be feared, however, that we shall then become mere dreamers. On the contrary, after we shall have penetrated to the reality hidden behind and within both dream and waking, we shall, henceforth, be done with dreams and learn to be truly and incessantly active, not only for our own benefit but also for that of others. Whereas the ignorant live blindly, we shall live in the light, and whereas they cherish illusions, we shall cherish truth. We shall not flee from this dream of earthly life, for we cannot. It is not our individual finite mind that brought this dream into being, and it is not our individual finite mind that can put an end to it. We shall accept it in all its comprehensiveness and not vainly seek to negate it. We shall firmly encourage action and not discourage it, but in the midst of our dream we shall be somewhat like a sleeping man who knows at the same time that he is asleep and dreaming. Thus we shall not suffer ourselves to be swept away by bitter nightmares or pleasurable reveries. Always we shall seek peace in place of agitation. From the unreal to the real, we have labored to cross a difficult frontier, but at different points of our journey a certain problem has met us again and again. It must now be faced. For the question will necessarily arise that if externally experienced things are but thoughts, do they exist at all? Is each object unreal? If so, how is it that our daily experience flagrantly contradicts such startling possibilities? None need be alarmed. We do not deny the existence of a single thing that forms part of our world experience. But we must get our minds clear about this problem. The experiments of Michelson and Morley, which preceded the experiments of Einstein, demonstrated that the velocity of light remained constant when all ordinary experience, common sense and scientific reason said that it ought to have risen to a much higher rate. Hence they were an astounding surprise. For this was not a mere piece of metaphysical speculation but a scientific piece of work performed with appropriate instruments. The experimental results contradicted what was expected. And what ought to have happened? Science might have got rid of this awkward piece of data by conveniently explaining it away as an illusion of the senses. But to its credit, it had the courage of accepting the illusion as a reality. Is the brigand which the observer sees in the bush a real one or not? If not, what is it? That the brigand was seen means that he exists, even if he exists only as an illusion. This brings up an important difference, that between the meaning of real and the meaning of exist. We may here seek to profit again by the lesson learned from the sixth chapter, where the need of analyzing words for the downfall of materialism of factual rather than apparent meaning was strongly emphasized. it is necessary to consider the question and to discover what we mean by these terms. For relativity also raised the entire issue. Properly to do this, we must first return to our earlier consideration of illusions. Both the brigand and the bush share the common characteristic of being experienced, and only in this way do they certify to their existence. But the first is negated by closer investigation, whereas the second is confirmed by it.